Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy, and we are here to preview week 13 of the college baseball season. Definitely coming down to crunch time here around the country. A lot of intriguing games to talk about with postseason implications and conference title implications. And we're also going to touch on, it's been a kind of a busy week of injury news. In terms of prominent players. So we'll get to some of that as well. But first, the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. All right, Joe, we're here. It's week 13. There's a gas crisis on the East Coast. So hopefully everyone's able to get to games that needs and wants to get to games this weekend without too much of a problem. But it's, like I said, it's getting down to crunch time. When I go through and put together the field of 64 projections, and when we talk about all that stuff, it's you look at schedules and it's like, oh, there are like five games left for them to do something with, or six or seven, eight, I don't know how many, however many games you're looking at, but it's not too many games left on anyone's schedule at this point.
Yeah, a couple things there. I was thinking about this weekend. I am not going on what I would call a significant drive trip this weekend, staying local, and I'm glad, because I would really truly have to kind of consider whether or not I want to do that, given the situation with the gas here. It's not great in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, in those states in particular. So I'm glad I don't have to make that decision. By comparison, going to Chapel Hill, which is, 15 minutes from my house, I was fortunate that I kind of by happenstance filled up my tank before this all happened. So I'm in pretty good shape, thankfully. So I'm glad I don't have to be in that position where I'm trying to decide whether or not it's worth it to risk it. Finding gas once I get to wherever I'm going. The other thing on the schedules, you mentioned teams will be having, a handful of games left. We're officially at the time of year when I click on a team's schedule page, or if I, are viewing schedules on, the Warren Nolan site, which you and I both use as a resource for RPI and stuff. Like, rather than just kind of slow scrolling now, the first thing I do when the schedule loads is do one big swipe just to kind of like scroll fast to the bottom, because I know that's easier than me just trying to like slow scroll to find the spot where I'm left off. And that's how I know we're getting close to the end of the season.
That is absolutely a good, like, yeah, at this point I usually just go page down on my keyboard. Now we're going all the way to the end, like, basically.
Yeah, I've never been a keyboard shortcut guy like that. I just can't, you know, I used to work in a tech company. We had a lot of developers and, you know, folks like that. And they were always big on that. I just never, it's never been part of my, like, my process, I guess. So you can't teach this old dog new tricks, I guess.
Yes. Well, in addition to crunch time, and we're gonna get to the series to watch this weekend here in a little bit. Joe, there's been some not insignificant injury news this week that is worth us talking about here. I think most significantly, you're looking at the most significant injury would be Ole Miss right-hander Gunnar Hoglund, preseason All-American, potential top 10 overall pick, Rebs Friday night starter. That Gunnar Hoglund is out for the season. He will be having Tommy John surgery. That comes after he missed a start a couple weeks ago, came back, and then this last weekend just recorded two outs before he left due to injury. You know, so it's been something that they've kind of been dealing with, but now he is out for the season, and that is a really tough blow to Ole Miss, particularly because they are still very much fighting for a hosting spot. They're 14-10 in the SEC, but now face a series against Vanderbilt this weekend that we'll talk about, and a trip to Georgia next weekend before the SEC tournament. So they really could have used Hoglund as they come down the stretch here, but they'll now have to sort things out without him, and he'll go and have surgery ahead of the MLB draft, and presumably his Ole Miss baseball career is now over.
Yeah, that's a big one, and I think Gunnar Hoglund is going to end up having one of those. Maybe he pitched enough this year to where maybe he avoids this a little bit, but it does strike me that he's going to be one of those careers where he had a really nice college career and accomplished a lot of things, but it's always going to feel a little bit incomplete when you talk about, you know, as a freshman, he had his struggles, and then it looked like he was really hitting a stride last year, and the season got canceled. And then this year, he obviously had taken a huge step forward, was one of the best arms in the SEC and in the entire country. And now he's having that season cut short by injury. And as part of that, he's not going to have the opportunity to kind of make those postseason memories and moments that really kind of often define college careers, especially in the SEC. Like, he's just not going to have that opportunity, and that sucks. I think he's destined for a nice pro career. So it's, you know, certainly all is not lost here. It's just kind of a bummer for him, but yeah, I think he's going to end up having one of those types of careers that we think about as like just being a little bit incomplete through no fault of his own at all. And for Ole Miss, this is tough because, you know, so much of any optimism you could have about Ole Miss, which has been relatively hard to come by lately. We talked about that on the last episode of the podcast, but is centered around, well, you still got Hoglund and Nikhazy. And so you feel pretty good about that at a bare minimum. And hey, in a regional, super regional in Omaha, as long as you stay on the right side of the bracket, like, you know, starting with those two starting pitchers gets you most of the way to what you need. So that obviously takes a big hit here and really puts into doubt what Ole Miss can do. And you mentioned the hosting spot. I mean, that was already a tough road for them. Now it gets obviously exponentially tougher.
Yeah, unfortunately, the hosting shortlist won't be announced until Friday. Depending on when you're listening to this, it may be announced. But as we record this on Thursday, we don't yet know who will be on it. But I am sure that Ole Miss will be included on that list because they are like 11th in RPI right now and have 14 SEC wins already. So if they were to just go 500 in the series against Vanderbilt and Georgia, they are probably looking at hosting. But I took them off the host line this week in the projected field of 64 because the Hoagland news had come out, and it's just really hard to see how they win this weekend against Vanderbilt or go to Georgia and win a series, considering all of the various pitching issues they're dealing with, both in terms of now Hoagland's injury and the various bullpen things that we've talked about over the last several weeks here about Ole Miss. So that's something to watch for sure, is how Ole Miss is going to move on without Hoagland in the rotation for the rest of the season. Also this week, we had news that Georgia left-hander Ryan Webb is done for the year. He has an elbow injury. The next course of action was not, has not been decided yet. But he's out for the season due to that injury. And that's really rough for Georgia as well, for a lot of the same reasons we talked about for Ole Miss. Webb isn't quite the prospect, but he is a draft prospect himself. He's, one of Georgia's most important pitchers. He's been their best starting pitcher this season. And, now they're going to be without him for their own stretch run as they try and secure an NCAA tournament bid. They face a really tough road of their own. They have Florida this weekend and then Ole Miss. And so without Ryan Webb, that's a really big blow. And Georgia has been hit really as hard as anyone, I feel like, this season by injury. Not to make that into a contest. I know Arizona State probably feels like they've really been hammered as well, and they have been. But Georgia started the season without Webb and Cannon due to illness. Webb had COVID issues. Cannon had mono, and now they're going to finish the season without Webb. Cannon's been he just hasn't been able to take that step forward that I think a lot of people projected for him because of his ailment, and UGA and CJ Smith as well has really been limited this season, and he is now also done for the year. So Georgia's dealing with some injury stuff. And then the other thing is also in the SEC is Jack Leiter is not, we're not 100% sure that Jack Leiter is going to pitch this weekend against Ole Miss. He, of course, had his start skipped last week due to fatigue/workload management. And the news out of Nashville this week from Tim Corbin was that Leiter really wanted to pitch this weekend, but they were still trying to see how he responded to throwing his midweek stuff, and then they were going to make a decision. So again, as we record this, not sure whether Leiter is going to be a part of that series against Ole Miss this weekend or not. Hopefully he is able to be a part of it and get back into it for the Doors. But injuries are starting to mount around the country. Possible to know whether this is due to workload stuff following the canceled last season, or whether this is just normal wear and tear stuff. Injuries to pitchers, after all, do happen. It's not like this is a unique season, but we're definitely seeing several of them around the country, and you can throw another preseason All-American, Jaden Hill, into that, who of course has now been out for the last couple months for LSU.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's just kind of seems like injuries are going to be one of the big storylines we're going to look back on this season. With time, of course, other things will come forward, but for right now, it really has affected a lot of different teams that we thought a lot about. And I have to admit that I thought at this point of the season, given the fact that we're still dealing with some of the effects of COVID, especially earlier in the season, I kind of expected we would be doing more of the game of, this guy didn't play last weekend and the team did though, and he seems healthy. So like, is it COVID ? Like, we really haven't had to do a lot of that. There, some of that early, we had some of that early on, but that largely has seemed to kind of go away. Now some of that just gets thrown into like, well, if you have more than a couple of those, like suddenly you just can't play and like games get postponed or canceled or whatever. So that's part of the reason, I'm assuming there, but so we've had less of that, but obviously the injuries have just been really, really a lot to deal with. I mean, you've had Ole Miss, which has been able to fight through up until this point, you know, having Tim Elko gone, like their offense has actually been pretty good. So, but this now kind of fundamentally changes what we think about them. Arizona State, I think we think about them completely differently. I mean, that's probably a team that we probably were a little too low on, as it turns out, if they had been healthy on the mound this season. You know, Texas Tech and Georgia, and you mentioned Jaden Hill at LSU. I mean, if Jaden Hill had been the Jaden Hill we expected, like, we certainly wouldn't be having the conversation about LSU, like, having to really fight just to even get onto the bubble. So, unfortunately, it's just been a year where injuries are a big storyline.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, injuries are just a part of the sport on an annual basis, but it does feel like this year, some teams in particular, I don't know if, like, on a national scale, if we've had more injuries than we usually do, but there have just been some real concentrations of them, unfortunately. And there actually probably are more on a national scale too. We'd have to, you know, really work to define what that meant and everything, but it has not been an easy spring in terms of injuries, and we're not past them by any means, of course, as the calendar approaches the middle of May here. All right, so that's kind of your quick newser on in terms of the injury stuff. You can read more about Hoglund's injury and how it affects his draft stock if you're interested in that over on the website. Carlos Collazo took care of that for us. Short answer, he probably still can be a first rounder if you're wondering about that. But you can get more than just that quick synopsis over on the website from Carlos. We'll get here to the top series to watch this week here in a second. But first, check this out. All right, Joe, we've reached that part of the Thursday podcast where we talk about the top series to watch this weekend, the, you know, keys for the teams to win those series, and just kind of run through what you need to be keeping an eye on around the country this weekend. It is, frankly, a lighter slate than last weekend. Last weekend was fantastic with all those first place showdowns around the country and a lot of top 25 series. This weekend, just not quite as much. I don't really know why that is. I think it's just a weird scheduling quirk more than anything. Last weekend really actually should have been worse than it was when you consider finals breaks, I think, were happening more commonly last weekend than this weekend. But as it is, this weekend is a little light, but we still get a top five series. And so we're going to start there. It is Arkansas, top-ranked Arkansas, heading to Tennessee. And the Vols, of course, are they're out there doing their thing. I guess this is not a top five series, it's a top 10 series. The Vols are still out there doing their thing, looking like one of the top teams in the SEC. They're actually tied with Vanderbilt for the SEC East lead. They, of course, did lose that series to Vanderbilt. So on tiebreaker, I guess as I say this, I don't have the SEC standings in front of me. They are actually a half game ahead of Vanderbilt because Vanderbilt did not play its third game last weekend. Anyway, point is, these are two of the top teams in the SEC, two of the teams fighting for the number one seed in Hoover. Should be a really fun one in Knoxville. But beyond that, it's a chance for Tennessee to prove that it belongs among the conversation for the sports, like, truly elite teams. You know, you're looking at a team that, again, is in the mix to win the SEC, but, you know, it lost a series to Vanderbilt. It beat Florida, but it those are kind of the two teams that it's had a crack at the top of the SEC. This is a crack at number one. So a really big opportunity now for Tennessee to prove that it is, an SEC title and a national title contender.
Yeah, it does feel like a big spot for them on a number of levels. One, you mentioned, like, again, like, it seems like we've had this conversation about Tennessee multiple times this year, but kind of just sneakily just is there. And I think this is another chance too. You know, you talked about, after the series against Vanderbilt, Tony Vitello saying that, you know, we'll learn from this series. This is an opportunity to learn that, hey, we're not quite ready. I'm paraphrasing, of course. We're not quite ready to win it at this level yet, but we're going to get there. And this is a stepping stone in that direction. Well, here's a shot for you. Number one team in the country coming to Knoxville. So it's at home. That there's obviously an advantage there. Side note, hopefully the bus trip isn't too far, because, you know, getting gas in Tennessee. Anyway, that's a just a little jokes there on the gas shortage. But I mean, this is an opportunity for, you know, Tennessee to kind of prove that, hey, we did learn something from that series loss against Vanderbilt, and then go out and prove it against a team on par, on that level. Obviously, Arkansas is that. One of the things with Arkansas, it's been kind of interesting for me. We talked about this a little bit, because, you know, I saw it against a little bit against South Carolina a few weeks ago, and it has kind of continued. And that's that, you know, Patrick Wicklander has been a different pitcher. You know, he really has, starting with that South Carolina series, kind of seemed to find another gear. You know, 6 2/3 shutouts against LSU, 5 2/3 shutout against Georgia last weekend, season high strikeouts last weekend against Georgia with 9. So maybe kind of slowly but surely, you know, they have hit on something a little bit in the rotation there with Wicklander. And then, of course, Copps, you know, has just been on a different level in the bullpen. And he's throwing basically starters innings every weekend, you know, getting, you know, 6 or 7 just from a couple of relief outings. And why the heck not, with the way he's throwing the ball? He's now second on the team in innings behind Wicklander in SEC games. So, but what I will say is, I do wonder if now it may not matter as much, because the offense is swinging the bats a little bit better, and they've maybe shown an improvement primarily with Wicklander in the rotation. But, you know, I guess I'll broach it again. You know, in SEC games, the team ERA is approaching 5, and Caden Monk is, other than Copps and Wicklander, Caden Monk is the only pitcher with an ERA under 5 in SEC games that is an often used pitcher. And again, I don't know how much it matters. Offense is good. Team plays good defense. They've started to be a little bit better in the starting rotation, at least in one spot, and they've got the best closer in the country, arguably. So maybe we shouldn't be too worried about it. But, you know, again, I will say, like, those numbers do paint a little bit of a story that, you know, if you can get past that, and that's a hard thing to do, there is some vulnerability there. It feels like nobody's just been able to do that, and maybe it's only just now been exposed to that same degree.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like, will that matter in the end? I don't know. You know, you're talking about a team, like, if we're going to talk SEC play, talking about a team that is, as a team, slugging 429 against SEC pitching. They have 32 home runs against SEC pitching. So, like, yeah, maybe you can get to their pitching a little bit, you know, and certainly, you know, guys like Lockhart and Vermillion have not been as good as they were early in the season. And Paulette is continuing to be a little more mixed than he was early in the season, but you're going to have to outscore them. And I've said it a lot that Arizona is the best offense in the country. I don't know, like, maybe it's time for me to kind of reevaluate that position, because this Arkansas offense is ridiculous. And you're just going to have to score with them. And I don't know how many teams are capable of doing that. You know, when you consider that you're right now going to have to, you know, of the 27 innings on an SEC weekend, 12 of them, it looks like, are coming against Wicklander and Copps. Copps is potentially the best pitcher in the SEC, potentially the best pitcher in the country. Like, he does lead the nation in ERA. It's unusual that we're talking about him in this way. But, you know, statistically, he's right there. You know, no one has matched really what he's doing on any real level. Like, can talk about Landon Sims all you want, but he has thrown like half as many innings. So, you know, it's a totally different thing what Copps is doing. And Wicklander is now taking a pretty significant step forward. So if you have to contend with those two guys for more than a third of the weekend, it's going to be a challenge to keep up scoring wise with the Hogs. And that's, unfortunately, not necessarily, I think, what Tennessee is out here trying to do. I think they would be much more comfortable in a pitching showdown. they have some guys that can run the ball out of the ballpark. That's for sure. You know, Evan Russell has really taken off here, and Jake Rucker is plenty capable of doing that. Like they are a good home run hitting team. But beyond that, I have some offensive questions about Tennessee. We'll see what they can do this weekend, and maybe it winds up being a more offensive weekend than I would expect. I do think these two teams are built somewhat similarly. Don't think that's an accident, considering Tony Vitello, came to Tennessee from Arkansas, where he was an assistant coach for a few years under Dave Van Horn. And I think that this is a really intriguing matchup, and Tennessee doesn't need to win this weekend to prove anything to anyone, but like we've talked about before, right now it just feels like it's Arkansas and Vanderbilt and then everyone else, and then maybe Mississippi State is closing the gap. If Tennessee wants to close the gap or to force us to kind of reevaluate the take that it is Arkansas, Vanderbilt, and then everyone else, they do need a win this weekend to do that.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something with it being a more offensive series you might anticipate, because in SEC games, and it's unbalanced schedule, I get it, SEC games, Tennessee's batting average and slugging are higher than Arkansas. And it does feel like they've shown some improvement in that regard. There are still some guys that haven't quite come along. Max Ferguson, for example, is hitting .224 in SEC competition. So that there are still some guys that we were expecting to be big parts of this that just haven't quite been that. And it is a home run based offense. They have 37 homers in SEC play. And we've seen that time and again, that they'll score five runs and four of them are on home runs. So that's, that part of it can sometimes come and go depending on things that are out of your control, weather, things like that. So we will have to see, but this is, I think this is
the ballpark here, though. I think it is worth noting, this being at Lindsey Nelson or even at Baum Walker, these are home run ballparks. And Lindsey Nelson, in that series against Vanderbilt did play very much to the home run ball.
Yeah. So, I think it very well could be the kind of offensive series that comes down to, prepare yourself, because maybe this is one of those series that comes down to a Sunday 13-9 kind of thing that takes 4 hours and 15 minutes. Because
now, Ole Miss tried to play that game against Arkansas and they lost.
Yep.
So Arkansas, if it comes to that. Yeah.
Right. They are.
If it comes to that, Arkansas will be plenty comfortable.
Pardon the metaphor. Arkansas is like a pig in mud in that in that type of situation. So that is definitely a type of game they are comfortable winning, because that is where, even if the pitching, the bullpen numbers kind of, you're like, well, is this bullpen good? Like that is where the bullpen shines, though, because that is the situation where they can really just throw volume at you on a Sunday and you run out of guys and they've still got guys. And so that would be a very comfortable situation for Arkansas if it plays out that way.
All right. Well, that's like I said, that's the top series of the weekend. Let's stay in the SEC, though. We kind of obliquely talked about this, at the start of the podcast. Ole Miss is hosting Vanderbilt. I'm very intrigued to see this series, just because I'm very intrigued to see what both of these teams look like this weekend. Like, how is Ole Miss going to work without Hoglund? How is Vanderbilt going to work either with or without Leiter? Because even if Leiter comes back, given what we know, I don't think they would just let him go back to throwing 100 pitches this weekend. I would think that he'd be on a tighter pitch count than that this weekend, given that he hasn't pitched in a week and that they're trying to manage fatigue or workload or whatever. I would think that you couldn't expect him to go 6 or 7 innings. You're looking at 5 if he's efficient, and more likely 3 or 4. So then what does that look like for Vanderbilt? And but it's also most likely a showdown of Nikhazy and Rocker, two great pitchers on Friday night. Should be a pretty offensively fun series. Ole Miss continues to hit the ball well, even without Elko in his regular role. He's now back as like a pinch hitter, I guess. We'll see if he can get into more than that down the stretch. But you know, it's a fascinating series. Vanderbilt was fine last weekend without Leiter against Alabama. This is a slightly different animal, though, as they go on the road to face one of the better offenses in the SEC.
Yeah, I don't. This is maybe based on very little, but I just kind of have a feeling based on maybe a little bit of an imbalance of motivation here, where Vanderbilt's got a very secure top eight resume at this point. They've just built up a lot of kind of stuff you need for a top eight resume, which is not to say going 0-6 down the stretch, which I don't anticipate, but 0-6 to finish the regular season can't undo some of that, but they are pretty secure here. And Ole Miss just really needs this if they want to host. And it does feel like Ole Miss is a little bit backs against the wall. And certainly the Hoagland injury probably makes it feel that way even more so. And it's always tough when you're betting on something like motivation or being fired up or, you know, standing up for your team. All that kind of stuff is just so intangible. You just never know. But I do have kind of a funny feeling that this is going to be like a last stand weekend for Ole Miss. You know, being at home, knowing that they have so much on the line here, you know, again, they probably feel really backed into a corner. And then you combine that with, you know, some of Vanderbilt's vulnerabilities, you know, whether that's the fact that teams have had a lot of success. I mean, even when Leiter has been healthy the last 4 or 5 weeks, like teams have had more success against him. Teams have had intermittent success against Rocker. And then we know the vulnerabilities Vanderbilt has in third games of series. And so, you know, when you consider that Ole Miss is, you mentioned that they continue to swing the bat well against, you know, or against the opposition without Tim Elko. I mean, it's by batting average might be the best offense in the SEC. That's not to say I think it is the best offense in the SEC, but batting average wise tells you that story. Which is kind of amazing considering we just thought, boy, you know, where's this production going to come from without Tim Elko? And they've had a lot of guys step up, whether it's Hayden Leatherwood or TJ McCant swinging the bat well. Kevin Graham has continued to be that kind of guy they need him to be. So they've just had a really good team effort there offensively. But I don't know, like it is kind of one of those intangible things, but I just kind of get the feeling that this is the type of weekend where Ole Miss comes out and plays inspired, but I guess we'll have to see.
Six regulars in this Ole Miss lineup are hitting above 300 in SEC play, which, yeah, I mean, it's they keep getting it done. I knew that Leatherwood wasn't going to stay down forever. Like he started the season very slowly. That just wasn't going to last. Getting Chatagnier back, of course, was important. He was hurt for a while. McCants has been a real difference maker this season, coming in as a freshman, playing really well. Obviously Justin Bench doing the same thing. Those two guys have been vital. And you know, I didn't see Justin Bench coming into the season. I didn't think Justin Bench was going to be running around with a 900 OPS at this stage of the season and his 12 steals. He's actually been hit by a pitch more times than he's either walked or struck out, which is remarkable. You know, they've got the pieces here to work without a fully healthy Tim Elko. And, you know, that's an absolute credit to the entirety of the Ole Miss lineup, the Ole Miss coaching staff, you know, for getting them ready, especially hitting coach Mike Clement and, you know, Carl Lafferty, their recruiting coordinator, for getting those guys to campus. Like it's really been impressive. But yeah, now with their backs against the wall, what can they do this weekend? And they're going to need somebody on that pitching staff besides Doug Nikhazy to step up, and besides Taylor Broadway. You know, I'm sure that you're looking at Drew McDaniel and Derek Diamond making starts this weekend. They're going to need the best from those guys, or at least from one of those guys. And, you know, they're also going to need the bullpen to come through. If they're going to make this an offensive weekend, you know, Vanderbilt is equipped to play in that, you know, with Keegan and Thomas and Rique Bradfield and CJ Rodriguez and Carter Young and Jason Gonzalez. They have a plenty good offense of their own. So you gotta be ready for that if that's the way you're gonna play it. But I think that you might be onto something, Joe, and just in terms of, you know, you never know what kind of emotional spike you might get from just knowing, like, hey, we that this is it now. We got to do it. There's no margin for error anymore. Like, we were playing for our friend now or whatever. Like, you never know how that's going to work. And Mike Bianco is a really good motivator. So I'm sure they're going to work to play on that. But at the same time, once the adrenaline wears off, you got to have something to back it up. And we'll see, particularly in the rotation, if Diamond and McDaniel are able to do that. All right, let's keep it moving and let's go to the Big Ten, Joe. This is a big one in the Big Ten. Got Indiana heading to Michigan. In the Big Ten, you've got three teams at the top really fighting for the league title. The Hoosiers, the Wolverines, and then Nebraska. So all three of these teams are going to play each other down the stretch. Any time that they do, it's going to be a big deal. That starts this weekend with the Hoosiers heading to Ann Arbor. Indiana continuing, of course, it's very, very challenging stretch here to close the season. 2 weeks ago, they won that series against Iowa to kick it off. And then this last weekend, they went to a pod at Rutgers, played Nebraska, played really well there, go 3-1. Hold on to first place in the Big Ten as a result. And now they got to do it on the road in Michigan against the preseason favorites. I'll be interested, first of all, to see how Indiana continues to handle this stretch. I mean, that's just a lot to ask of a team to, not have any sort of break in terms of playing contenders to the Big Ten title. And that's what they're doing right now. And then also here going on the road, something that Indiana hasn't, they did last week to that pod, but this is a true road game, true road three game series. What's that going to look like for them? And then, Michigan has been an interesting team. I don't think they've gotten it done the way that I expected them to. I expected them to be in this position. I just didn't think they were going to get here this way. They have been a more offensive team than I realized that they would be. Steve Hadger and Cameron Weston have been great at the front of the rotation. But they've, I remember writing their preseason capsule and preseason Big Ten stuff and thinking, well, okay, but where is Michigan's offense coming from? And they've done just fine offensively. They have 48 home runs as a team. They're hitting .278 as a team. They're scoring a lot of runs. It is honestly one of the best offenses in the Big Ten. And IU's got a really powerful offense as well. So I just think this is a fun weekend of baseball in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, I totally agree. Kudos to Eric Bakich and his staff on the transfer portal. Benjamin Sims, Christian Molfetta, two best hitters per average on the team. Two big hits in the transfer portal for Michigan there. And that is not always a sure thing, obviously. Teddy and I have pointed out privately, just in Slack, pointing out here and there, just some of these, teams that took on big grad transfer classes or just, four to four transfers just in general that have not really worked out because it's just such a hard thing. Sometimes it's a hard thing to pull off, but Michigan has, even not having the full complement of guys we thought they would have from a grad transfer perspective, have gotten a lot from those two guys. And that feels like it's been a game changer for them offensively. Because they are leading the way. Michigan, they won 3 of 4 with Iowa to begin the season. And I think we could agree that's a different Iowa team than what we're seeing now. They're playing better just generally. And they won that series against Ohio State. And, I don't want to take that away. But, they do feel like a team that kind of is looking for another statement series win. And I think this is an opportunity to do so here with the Big Ten leaders in Indiana. Because otherwise, it's, a lot of wins against, Michigan State and Illinois and Minnesota, Penn State, Purdue. So that there's a lot of the weaker teams in the Big Ten. So they finish up with a tough, Indiana, Maryland, Nebraska. So we're about to see it all front and center here. And this game, by the way, Sunday, ESPN2. Hopefully this one actually happens on ESPN2 versus the Ohio State series, which very much did not and was played in probably the worst weather I've ever seen a game tried to be played in this year when you consider the temperature and the fact that it was drizzling the way it was. There were a couple things
drizzling, to put it mildly. Dave Van Horn thinks it was drizzling. If you're familiar with the gif of Dave Van Horn yelling, "It's not even raining," while it's clearly like pouring rain.
You're right. It was harder than that. I actually flipped away from that game for a while, so maybe it was raining. You know, the Kentucky Florida series had a game last weekend where Nick Della Torre, covers the Gators, tweeted about, like, "I don't know why these players are still on the field." And I had flipped away from the game for a second, and I came back when I saw that tweet. And I kid you not, when I turned on the game on the ESPN app, from the center field camera, it was just a particularly bad moment, I guess, but I literally could not see the batter. That's how hard it was raining. Now, that, again, looked like the wind had just picked up a lot in that moment. That was part of it, because it was whipping the rain all over the place. But that would probably actually take the cake. But the cold on that day, I assume, for Michigan and Ohio State.
If you didn't watch, so Michigan blew out Ohio State in that game. Ohio State like put some runs on late. So if you go look up the score, it like won't look that bad. So you went away from that game, but they had moved that game up to try and beat the weather, and they didn't quite, like, they just kept it going. I'm not quite sure why. I've never really like looked into it. But like as the day progressed there, the weather deteriorated in Ann Arbor that day.
Yeah, I do remember that kind of taking like a long time. Like, my goodness, they're still playing this game. But
Michigan scored like 18 runs or something.
Yeah. A couple things for Indiana that we've talked about, their pitching before being pretty good this year. But I think there's a couple things that are important here. One is Gabe Bierman has been like excellent. And, you know, he was a guy who I wasn't quite sure what to think of. He reminds me a little bit just in terms of, in a few ways, of like when Indiana had a rotation led by Paulie Milto. And I think Bierman's stuff is better than Milto's. Actually, I know it's better than Milto's, but he kind of reminds me of that in terms of, like, you look at the stuff and you're like, okay, but then the numbers just show that he's a lot better than you would probably just assume. You know, he's holding batters to a 168 average. His strikeout to walk ratio is good. And he's just had standout start after standout start. Last weekend against Nebraska, one earned run in a complete game with 11 strikeouts. I mean, he's really been, really, really good for them. And then McCabe Brown has bounced back a little bit. I was a little bit worried the last few weeks that maybe there'd been a little bit of fool's gold with McCabe Brown early this season, when his first two starts were absolutely dominant. And he's not gotten back to that necessarily, because that was just otherworldly what he did against Rutgers and Penn State to start the season. But last weekend against Rutgers again, so maybe this is a Rutgers problem, but one hit and one run over seven innings with 11 strikeouts, which was a lot better than most anything else he'd done in the previous 6 weeks. So perhaps he is flattening out a little bit in a good way, as opposed to kind of being very up and down throughout that part of the season, because, you know, he's really a game changer. You know, Indiana gets in a regional, they feel pretty good about Bierman and Tommy Summer at least being steady. But having McCabe Brown be that version of McCabe Brown, versus the one that struggles to throw strikes and ends up just throwing 2 2/3 innings because he's given up a few runs and has 70 pitches on his ledger, that one is not going to be effective in the regionals. And so maybe we still don't know which one we're going to get, but certainly he's trending in the right direction lately.
I think it's a really good first two pitching matchups here. You talked about what IU has, and then, you know, Michigan running out Hadjer and Weston in those first two games. I think that that's really intriguing, just from a pitching standpoint. I don't know what this third game looks like if they get to it as a rubber game. Like, Indiana is deeper on the mound. Like, this is total role reversal from what I would have expected, that Indiana seems to be deeper on the mound and Michigan seems to be deeper offensively. So, like, which the series might pivot on which one of those team, like which team is able to take control and play the game it wants to play on Sunday. Like, is it a offensive battle, in which case Michigan probably has to be favored, or is Indiana's superior pitching depth, does that come to bear on a Sunday? And I don't know which way to expect it to go at all. It would be really interesting to see how it would shake out. And if Indiana, if they can get that kind of strong performance from Gabe Bierman on a Sunday that they typically have been getting, I think that would be a really big deal for them. If this comes to a rubber game, you know, after he beat Iowa in a rubber game, Bierman, you know, talked about how, you know, he he didn't care whether he pitched on Sunday or Friday or Saturday. He just wanted to pitch in the rotation. But also it seemed clear that he did kind of enjoy the prospect of being the guy who was entrusted to go out and win a series. And he's statistically been their top starting pitcher this season. So, you know, if it comes to it, Indiana probably is going to feel good about themselves, but the Michigan offense is a real challenge for any team to try and shut down, especially on after, you know, you've already played 18 innings over the first 2 days of a weekend.
It's Big Ten just generally has been interesting because I think it's broken in such a way that, and you spend more time with this than I do because you're doing the field of 64 every week, but it does feel like it's broken in such a way where, and we talk about this a lot in the preseason, kind of figuring out what the Big Ten is going to look like and what that means. And it does feel like it's gone in a direction where it's been able to kind of maximize the number of teams that it has, at least in the postseason conversation, while also basically shutting itself out from having any sort of hopes to host a regional.
Yeah, this has been a topic this week, of course, as host sites, you know, that shortlist is about to come down. And, you know, it's I don't see a case for a Big Ten team to host unless you're like that isn't based in geography or growing the game, air quotes on that. And frankly, they don't need the geographical, like they don't need a Big Ten host to get the geography because they got Pitt and Louisville if they want that, in addition to Notre Dame. So shouts to the ACC for bringing Midwestern baseball plenty of host sites if they want it. And like in a normal year where they're like not in a year where they're announcing host sites at the normal time and the Big Ten is still doing its conference only thing, like in that world, I think that maybe you wait 3 weeks, you see who the Big Ten champion is, and then you say like, okay, did they separate themselves enough to determine that this is the best team in the Big Ten, and then maybe we host them. But it's not like the selection committee has been in the business of giving the Big Ten champion a host site very often. You know, the Big Ten champion typically does not host. So why in a year when they're not playing, you know, non-conference to further bolster their resumes, why would we think that they would just get a host? You know, now maybe if you were talking about trying to balance geography, you know, maybe there's something to be said for that. Nebraska doesn't help you do that hardly at all. You're really boxing yourself into what the Lincoln Regional would be. If you're talking about geography, you're really just saying like, here's the Summit League champion as your four, hoping that Creighton wins the Big East so that they can be your three, I guess. Although Creighton might be a four were they to win the Big East. And then, you know, hope like here's Oklahoma State as your two or something like that. That's what the Lincoln Regional has to look like from a geography standpoint. So you're really boxing yourself in there if that's the reason for a host. And then Michigan, Indiana didn't even bid, but in a world where they did, you know, it's really no different to have a regional in Ann Arbor or in Bloomington than it is to have one in Pittsburgh or Louisville. So it's just hard to see how it's helpful to do that. And then in terms of a traveling one seed, you know, were it to come to that, like I don't really see what you would be basing that on again, because unless one of these teams takes off over the final 3 weeks, it truly separates, you know, like, again, the Big Ten champion is usually not a one seed. That's not where we've been. I mean, right or wrong, and like I would obviously lean more on the wrong side of that being the case, but that's how the Big Ten has been evaluated in normal seasons. So in a year that's abnormal, where they aren't playing non-conference, and where the standings look the way they do right now, where you have three teams separated by one game, it's just really hard for me to say that whoever comes out as the champion, if it's still going to be as tight as it is, that team would deserve you know, a one seed or a host site. Thank you for coming to my TED talk.
Yeah, I debated, like, I was like, no, that seems like a good place to end. Like, I don't need to, you know, jump in and add anything else to that. Well said.
All right, so let's move on to the ACC here for the last series I'm picking here. And you know, the ACC has some intriguing series this weekend. None of them are like truly like blockbuster though, but you know, you're looking at like Louisville goes to North Carolina, and North Carolina, you know, really needs this to a series win here if they want to pad their resume at all. Like right now they're very bubbly, and right now I have them bubble out, but you know, you can probably find someone with them bubble in. That they are just truly right on the bubble there. And Louisville famously needs to pad its hosting resume. And you've got, so you've got that, you've got Virginia against Wake Forest. And you know, we've talked about how badly Virginia needs this, and Georgia Tech and Miami. And like, those are two of the teams battling for a division title. And it probably won't matter, because I doubt Georgia Tech's going to be announced as a host candidate this week. But if they are, like, that means something. You got Florida State and Clemson, and Florida State probably will be announced as a host candidate, so they need to bolster their resume. Clemson's right on the bubble. I say all that to say, though, Joe, we're going to talk about Pitt and NC State, because I think these are the two best teams that are playing this weekend. I just think it's the best on-field series. It may not have the most implications, though Pitt could use the series win to bolster its host qualifications. And NC State is trying to, you know, make itself a two seed as opposed to a three seed in a world where that may or may not matter. I don't know. But I just think this is the best on-field series. And it's been a while since we talked Wolfpack. And quietly, they've come on pretty strong. They're above 500 in the ACC now after a dreadful start that included some COVID issues of their own. But they're back now. And they're dealing now with a Pitt team that is back after a two-week break. They come back last week after a two-week break. They go 2-2 against West Virginia and Boston College. Those teams are not super great this year. They're not bad, but they're not bad either. So to go just 2-2 against them wasn't like a huge, like, okay, Pitt is right back to where they were. I think they're going to have to be much more back to where they were playing before if they want to handle this NC State team, which all of a sudden is playing pretty well, although they're coming off of a break of their own for finals.
Yeah, I think NC State, I wrote about this for Three Strikes a few weeks ago. I think NC State's figured out some things that have allowed it to move forward. Because, I mean, it was a pretty deep trough they fell into. It was 1-8 in the ACC, all of which were at home. They played a lot of early home games, because remember, the ACC play started so early, they needed to make sure that, you know, there were certain teams that just could not reasonably, you know, host games that early. So a lot of home games for the Wolfpack early. They really fell into a hole, and they've spent the rest of the season clawing their way out of it. And, you know, pitching has been the biggest issue for NC State. And we kind of knew that going in, because the position player group is really good. And actually, you know, it's kind of working its way back too, because there are a number of guys who really got off to slow starts there that are now more or less rounding into form. But the pitching has figured some things out, and I feel like that's important. I don't think it's the type of pitching staff that is going to blow anybody away, and I'll get to why that's important in a minute. But they do at least kind of know who their guys are, and that's an improvement over where they were to kind of start the season. But they more or less have a rotation now of Sam Heifel and Reed Johnston and Matt Willardson. And those guys have all been varying degrees of pretty good. You know, Willardson has had, you know, really good outings in the past, like against when they played Louisville, that was his first start in this role. And he was really good. And so like, he's really shown those flashes. And Sam Heifel, same way. Reed Johnston, obviously a little more of the savvy veteran there, where he's, you know, he's kind of been around the block with this team. And then in the bullpen, their go-to guy is Evan Justice, who still has some ugly numbers by his name, you know, a 5.25 ERA, but if you take out the starts, his numbers are actually pretty good in the bullpen. So that's a deal where they moved him into a little different role. He shined in that role, and the numbers have just taken a long time to kind of catch up to what he actually is doing on the mound. So he's actually turned into a really effective stopper at the back end. You know, why I say it's kind of important that this isn't a pitching staff that's really going to dominate anyone, though, is because the one thing you and I have both said about Pitt's offense is, you know, it's not a super explosive offense necessarily, and you can get them with the strikeout. It's an offense that does strike out quite a bit. You know, they strike out almost three times as often as they walk. And the NC State pitching staff is not really necessarily the pitching staff to exploit that. You know, I talked about how good those three starting, or how solid, I guess I should say, those three starting pitchers have been. Well, none of them are striking out more than a batter per inning. In fact, of the pitchers who have, you know, been a big part of this, Evan Justice is really the one that, that has kind of that strikeout punch, but it's not like his numbers are, he's no Kevin Copps, we'll put it that way. So that feels like an opportunity where Pitt could have some success, because as long as they're going to be able to have competitive at-bats, they have more of a chance. And this is not a situation where NC State's probably going to come in there and pile up huge strikeout numbers. So it'll be a little bit of a weakness versus weakness matchup there that, that one side or the other will need to exploit. And I guess I give a little bit of the favor to Pitt there.
Here's the thing though. NC State is 12-3 in road games. Two of those losses come against the Omaha Irish. So like, we'll move on from those. Like they're 12-3 in road games and they're at Pitt this weekend. I don't like, obviously that's pretty fluky, but also what if it's not? Like, I don't know. I remember a couple years ago, Elliot Avent talked about how like they went to Hawaii on opening weekend, I think. And like, that was really the only like serious road thing that they scheduled, but they started poorly. And he was just really beating himself up for like how hard he'd scheduled early on. And like the Hawaii series was clearly a part of that. And like now seeing that they're 12-3 on the road, it's like, well, maybe this was the year that like you should have scheduled more road games. You know, maybe that would have been a beneficial arrangement. But it's an interesting thing. I don't know how much it actually matters, but it does clearly say that they're comfortable playing on the road, that they're not going to be bothered. I think it also says that they played Wake, Boston College, and UNC, who they swept, and UNC is a legitimately solid team, but that they probably lined up a little better with road series. I think that's part of why that they're 12-3 on the road.
They probably also slept in their own beds when they played that game. And
that is true. How much does that count? And the Wake thing as well. You know, that's they're probably staying in Raleigh for that. Maybe the truest road games they've played were BC and Notre Dame. I think it's an interesting point that you're making about the strikeout stuff. I do think though that, you know, yes, while Pitt does strike out a fair amount, that, you know, NC State does a good job. You know, Clint Chrysler, their pitching coach, does a good job of like getting these guys ready to pitch their games. And so even if they're not going to whiff Pitt a bunch, you know, maybe they can figure out how they need to get these Pitt hitters out without doing it via strikeout. And NC State is a really good fielding team. This is a team fielding 984. They've got one of the best defensive shortstops in the country in Jose Torres. They've got a lot of speed and athleticism around the diamond. So I think that if NC State can find some ways to pitch to their strength, to let Pitt make some contact, I think that they've got a real shot this weekend.
Oh, it's a great point. And that's kind of, the defense is shockingly good for NC State. You know, there was one point this season where they had, you know, not made an error in 12 of 13 or 12 of 14 or something like that. And that's just, I mean, errors, just so many inconsequential errors happen, you know, like they're just, they happen in college baseball games. And so the fact that they go so often without making one is just kind of incredible. Interesting matchup on the other side too, because Pitt's pitching, especially Mitch Myers and Matt Gilbertson in the rotation, have kind of more or less also been what NC State has been, where neither of them are real dominant, but they are solid. And I think where Pitt has an edge is they typically get a little more depth from those two guys with Myers and Gilbertson. But this is also not like the NC State position player group is certainly not an offense that you feel real comfortable like looking to pitch to contact to. Whereas, you know, with Pitt's offense, it's like, well, they have the strikeouts. And also there are a couple guys that can really hurt you. Maybe you can work around them a little bit. NC State's lineup is a little bit different, where there's not a ton of break in the lineup. And sure, there are examples of guys that maybe aren't hitting as well as you thought. You know, Luca Trash is in just a season long kind of tailspin after a really, really fast start. And JT Jarrett hasn't been as good as you thought, or Devontae Brown, what have you. But those guys are good hitters. Like, that's a pretty deep lineup. And so that's a matchup there where, you know, those two guys have kind of gotten along on, you know, minimizing damage and pitching to contact a little bit. And I'll be interested to see how effective that is against an NC State position player group that can, one, really work a count. That's something they can do. And then also every single guy in the lineup can hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. So Pitt needs this one. If they're trying to stay in the hosting race, the further they fall behind Georgia Tech, if they fall behind Georgia, they're behind Georgia Tech now. The further they fall behind in the division race, were that to happen over the final 2 weeks, the worse it's going to look for their hosting resume. They already don't really have the right RPI. We've talked about RPI and ACC schools forever. The thing that they have going for them, though, is like that they should be, you know, right there atop their division. They need to stay there. Otherwise, some of the other things they have on their resume, like the sweep at Florida State, probably will start to matter a little bit less. So they really need, I think, to take advantage of playing at home this weekend and come away with a series win. All right, Joe, those are my picks for the top matchups to watch this week. Let's get another one here. And, you know, your pick usually is a little further off the radar. So what do you got for the folks to watch this week?
Okay. I feel like I'm really, last couple of weeks, we had a MAC series last week, and this one will also be right in your strike zone. So I feel like we're really playing to you. But one other just to mention, I had or a couple others to mention that I had as backups if my primary choice got elevated, because I knew it wasn't a great week and could possibly have gotten elevated. Campbell and USC Upstate play two best teams in the Big South. Campbell took 2 of 3 in Buies Creek earlier this season. I was there, as they say. Upstate has proven to be the better team, though, long-term. Interesting at-large case, if they don't win the automatic bid, is USC Upstate. So that will be an interesting series in the Big South.
Right now, by the way, just quickly on that, I would say Upstate would probably be in, and this weekend wouldn't be a big negative to them, because they would, like, Campbell's like top 60, top 50 in RPI.
Yeah.
But Upstate would really behoove them, if they're not going to win the tournament, to win the regular season. Because if you don't do that, it starts getting dicier out of some of these conferences.
For sure. And that's in Upstate, by the way, if you're a fan of an SEC team, ACC team, Upstate is a team that you don't necessarily want to pop up in your region. Now, they probably won't be a four. I mean, if they're an at-large team, they won't be a four. But that's certainly a team, if you're an ACC two, that's uncomfortable, because though they have real pitchers on that roster led by Jordan Marks. So that's not a real comfortable matchup for you if you end up.
Also, interestingly, as we talk Upstate at-large bids, they just added a midweek next week against Louisville. So,
yeah.
I mean, we know why Louisville's adding that, since they have RPI issues. But that seems to indicate that Upstate is like looking at it and saying, like, okay, what do we need to do to make sure we get in as an at-large? And, oh, wait, Louisville needs a game. Like, let's play that.
Yeah. Yeah. We are officially in midweek game moving season. We've also had a lot of cancellations, which a lot of it's been weather, but we're also at the time of year where it doesn't take more than like a drizzle for coaches to be like, you know what, do we need to do this? Because it is that time of year after all. The other series I had, there's a couple big ones in the Mountain West. And we talked about the Mountain West a little bit last week. So, but the top four teams are playing each other. San Diego State is playing UNLV. San Diego State still technically leads the conference race, but as we've discussed, the conference records in the Mountain West are so wonky, it's hard to kind of keep, it's going to be a percentage points thing. I can just feel it. But the series I was going to focus on a little is Nevada and Fresno. Nevada also has an interesting at-large resume. We talked a little bit with reference to Air Force in Nevada in that way, but Nevada, I feel like, has taken a little step forward in terms of at-large chances goes. So if they were to finish a half game behind San Diego State, now that Mountain West is not doing a conference tournament, so there's no, like, if they don't need the auto bid, it's whoever wins the league. And if they finish a half game back with an RPI 40 or so, like, that's kind of interesting. But they're playing Fresno, and Fresno is the hottest team there. Now, they've won 6 in a row. And kind of my question coming into the series was, is Fresno, you know, they've beaten some of the worst teams in the conference to win those 6 games in a row. So is Fresno figuring some things out, or is this more they're just beating up the bottom of the league? I think we would have found out this weekend. It's really Fresno's last chance. They're three games back, last chance to really get into that mix there. So that was my other series. But
before we move on from that, shout out to Tyler Bassetti, who has homered in 9 straight games, 10 home runs, 9 straight games. That's an NCAA record. He has 11 home runs on the season. Yeah. So like this is, I don't want to say it's totally come out of nowhere, but also it's kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like he was like, before the season, he was using a bat that was too short or something, like, and they gave him the right bat. Now he's like, oh yes. Okay. No wonder it was so hard. Yes. I had that on my list of notes if I ended up having to do that series. But we're actually going to talk about the Patriot League semifinals. They are moving to the postseason.
Do we have Drummond Fife?
I wish we did. I wish we did, but I actually just recently sent those and donated them. So I no longer have those in my possession. So we've got Lehigh taking on Navy. We've got Army taking on Lafayette in the semifinals this weekend. I'm scrolling to make sure I have that right, but I think Teddy would have corrected me if that wasn't. Yes. Lehigh and Navy, Army and Lafayette. I think it's an interesting set of semifinals. First off, because I don't think there'll be a huge part of this discussion. Shouts to Lafayette for getting there. First time they've been in the Patriot League tournament in back-to-back years since 2011, 2012. And of course, we're counting 2019 as last year because there wasn't a tournament last year. So that's a big deal for a program that has had a hard time having consistent success. They've got a little bit of a pesky offense. I don't think they're probably in the mix here. Lehigh has the best pitching staff in the conference. Obviously, Mason Black is the big name there. If you're someone who pays attention to draft stuff, you know who Mason Black is.
Or this podcast.
Or this podcast guests. Yeah, we did. Yeah, it's true. He was really good. Yeah, so we had Mason Black on the podcast. But Matt Svensson, Luke Rettig, a couple of the other starters are maybe the second and third best pitchers in the conference, depending on how you measure that. So the pitching staff is really, really deep. The questions for Lehigh, though, offense is just average. Defense is not particularly good. They field 959 as a team. A lot of pass balls, you know, and sometimes scoring can have something to do with like pass balls versus wild pitch and all that. So I don't want to hammer them too hard on that, but it does appear that defense is a little bit of a shortcoming for Lehigh, and they'll have to obviously play more solid to win the auto bid. Army and Navy, of course, are in the mix here. Army might be the most well-rounded team in the conference. They're like second in the conference in everything: ERA, batting average, fielding percentage. They've also got a lot of DNA still from those the teams that have been so good in recent years. And it's a similar story with Navy. Navy, best offense in the conference, and still has a handful of guys who were around for the regular season title in 2019 who played big roles on that team as well. So I think it's going to be a competitive conference tournament. I still bet on Lehigh because with those three starting pitchers in a best out of three situation, which is how they play the semis and the finals, I think you have to look at them as the favorite. But Army and Navy, I think, are going to be in the mix as well.
Yeah, so I think Lehigh clearly the favorite. They have not won the regular season Patriot League title since 2006. They get that done this year. They have been building to this. When they brought in the recruiting class that included Black and Rettig a few years ago, now they're third year players. Sean Leary, the Lehigh coach, was all over how good those guys were, and it was a great job for Lehigh to get in on them. They're local-ish. I think Mason Black like literally is local. They're local-ish. They got in early. They kept him. They got him to Lehigh, and you know Mason Black has exploded since then, starting the Cape Cod League All-Star Game after his freshman season, becoming a really high-end draft prospect this year. He's going to go very well. Lehigh has become a really good pitching development place. Most of their recent draft picks have been pitchers, looking at guys like Levi Stout. So they've definitely got something going there. You mentioned how their offense is a little more suspect. And like, while that's true, they do have the Patriot League Player of the Year, Casey Rother, at the front of this thing. He's their leading hitter, 350. He's got 5 jacks. Patriot League's not the world's most offensive league, tends to be a little more pitching dominated. So having a guy like that in your offense, I think is really significant for them as well. Navy is intriguing. I think of them a little more pitching wise usually, but I don't think that's fair. They always have good hitters as well. They just don't really have the standout ace this year. That might ultimately be what's holding them back the most. They also, I think, dealt with some COVID stuff for a while. That might have like that knocked out a few weekends for them. For me, though, if a team is going to beat Lehigh over the next 2 weeks, it would be Army. Army had, under Jim Foster, has just been really consistently great at playing in the Patriot League tournament. Anytime I go and I write a Patriot League preview every year, I'm like, oh, well, like Army won this thing last year, didn't they? I'm like, no, they don't. What they do is they win the tournament. They are amazing at winning this thing. I think they've won three of them under Foster. It might be two in one last year. I think they've won three in like the last like four or five, something like that. And they have a couple times gone to Annapolis to do it. Navy has won the regular season title, and then Army finds a way to beat their arch rivals in the Patriot League tournament in Annapolis. So I don't want to rule out what Army is capable of doing here. They, like you mentioned, a lot of players still are there from those teams. Now, however, because they're service academies, they might have gone an extra year in the NCAA's eyes, but the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy didn't necessarily see it that way. So they aren't maybe as veteran as some of the other teams around, but they do have players that were a part of that. And clearly they just have something clicks in the Patriot League tournament for Army. And Lehigh is a team that has very little experience in this kind of situation. So does that come to play, or can their talent carry the day for them? That is really what I'm going to be watching for the next 2 weeks here.
Yeah, the Patriot League tournament might not necessarily, for you general listener here who's a fan of some other team conference, might not be necessarily on your radar, but one, I think it's going to be a pretty interesting tournament, and secondarily, it does mean that postseason baseball is back in your lives, and we need to celebrate that at every turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, normally we would have talked about Army Navy playing last week. They played their series last week. I usually try and make that into a bigger thing, because part of my like whole, what was some bailiwick of mine has developed as like college baseball does a really bad job of highlighting its rivalries. And so I try and highlight them when I can. But that went really far under the radar. And like, that is super duper on me. But you know, that they are, I like what Army has this year, like Anthony Gianchin in their lineup, has just a really good veteran player, but you know, Navy played really well last weekend. So they're probably going to feel like they're coming into this tournament in a good spot. I don't want to underplay what Navy is capable of this season.
One final thing I will say, I meant to mention this in my other series to watch. This is more of just a kind of a sentimental thing in some way. Florida A&M is playing at NC Central. Try to get out to maybe the finale of that last home series for NC Central before that program goes away. They obviously still have a lot to play for. They're going to be in the MEAC tournament. They'll have a chance to win that auto bid. That would be a cool story. Obviously, they've certainly got the arms to do it. But last home regular season series for NC Central as a program, they will be vacating Durham Athletic Park. And I have to wonder what Durham will become of Durham Athletic Park once NC Central moves out. So kind of a historic facility there that isn't going to have a primary tenant. So we'll have to see on that. But
you listener know it best as the setting of Bull Durham.
Correct. Yeah. Now it's a pretty neat little setting for NC Central. It's right downtown, and it's got a chain link fence all the way around it. So people, rather than go in the stadium, people just kind of stand outside the chain link fence with like their beers from the bar next door and their coffees and from the coffee shop across the street, and people walking their dogs stop and watch. And it's kind of got a community vibe to it. It's kind of a cool deal, but last home series there. So kind of a sad weekend for NC Central baseball.
Yes, absolutely. That is that and LaSalle, of course, are stories to watch down the stretch here, as those two programs only have a few weeks left in their life. Both of them will be cut following this season. That is a good one to highlight as well. And also the MEAC is like totally wide open. Trying to pick what team to give the auto bid to on a week-to-week basis there is a mess. So NC Central has a real opportunity to to go out and win the MEAC tournament, I would think, considering their arms. And this weekend against FAMU, a chance to position themselves better, get a better seed going into that thing. So definitely something to watch there as well. All right, so we hit on the big series around the country and then several of the smaller ones. It's like I said, as we get down to crunch time, there are a lot of these series that just they have a lot of meaning to conference title and postseason races. So plenty to watch. We'll have it all covered for you over at baseballamerica.com. And you can find further analysis from the two of us on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. We will be back here with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast next week on Monday to recap all of the action from around week 13, around the country. There it is. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America Podcast in your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. We appreciate you all for subscribing. We appreciate you all for listening. And we thank Rapsodo for presenting this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast, as they always do. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.